I'm Jeffrey Church from the Department of Political Science at the University of Houston. This is the Political Theory Review, a podcast of conversations with authors of recent books on political theory and social and political philosophy. Today, I'm talking to Yvonne Chu, associate professor in the Strategy and Policy Department at U.S. Naval War College. We're discussing her 2019 book, Conspiring with the Enemy, The Ethic of Cooperation in Warfare from Columbia University Press, which won the North American Society for Social Philosophy Book Award. Chu works on just war theory, international ethics, comparative political thought, and authoritarianism. She has written articles in leading political science and philosophy journals, and op-eds and essays on foreign affairs. So first of all, Yvonne Chu, let me say welcome to the Political Theory Review.
Thank you.
Well, Yvonne, I loved the book. I really enjoyed reading all about the many different, especially the examples that you use throughout this book of military conflict that you draw from history, literature, and film, all to sort of contribute to a really, you know, interesting original argument here about different forms of cooperation and warfare. So I found the book really lively and illuminating, and I appreciate it. Can you start by talking a little bit about the motivation for writing a book in the first place?
So I guess I've been interested in various aspects of military ethics for a long time, and started off as just some of the challenges that you see in liberal democracies when you have warfighters come home and they struggle quite a bit with reintegrating into civilian life. And going to war is, you know, and sometimes it's kind of like the movies. Most of the time, it turns out when you're on extended deployments, it's just long periods of boredom punctuated by, you know, frenzied activity and terror. But then there's all this apparatus around the institution of the military and enormous, discipline and rigidity and training. And then you come and even when you have a fair amount of leeway in the military, civilian life in a liberal democracy is a lot different. And so I was really interested originally in the challenge of warfighters coming home and having to deal with that and struggling with reintegrating into a society that they were protecting as their profession, but not being able to understand, a lot of the excesses of commercial life and bourgeois living and license and all these things. So that was kind of the original interest in the military. And then over time, I started thinking more about military ethics in general and how that might be related to the domestic values of a liberal democracy. Again, because you have these certain domestic principles governing, certain values and principles governing domestic society, which don't always, which are not always, true in a military as an institution and in the military as a fighting apparatus. And specifically with this project, as I was studying just war theory, I started noticing this phenomenon of enemies cooperating with each other in war as they're trying to kill each other, which is, which is kind of interesting. It's not just, your enemy of your enemy is the enemy of your enemy is your friend, and so you're cooperating for, immediate self-interest and immediate gains, but you're still trying to kill each other, but trying to put some parameters on it. And this is something that game theory has discussed, certainly, but I started thinking that maybe there's a lot more to it. The game theory wasn't capturing all of this phenomenon, and this was important for us to understand as a liberal democracy that's concerned with military ethics, but also because it can in some cases conflict with just war theory, which is the dominant paradigm that we use to think about war. And so then that led to this book, which became a very long project.
Yeah, good. Okay, so I loved, like you just said, the sort of premise of the book, the idea of cooperating in warfare, even despite the fact that the combatants are trying to kill one another. And the book is an extensive examination of this cooperative behavior in warfare. I think maybe we could start by talking generally about cooperation in warfare and what you mean by it, because it isn't, at least I thought when I read the title of it, I thought this was about, well, you know, conspiring with the enemy, that there's, you know, some sort of like espionage element too. This is not conspiring with the enemy. This is, in some ways, the sort of rules and norms that we place on war to, I guess, civilize it in a certain way, like eliminate the barbaric character to it and bring some civilization to it. So you could start just by saying a little bit about what you mean by cooperation in war and give some examples.
Right. So I think you're right. The title Conspiring with the Enemy is a little misleading. It wasn't intentional. I couldn't come up with a better title for the book.
No, it's good. It's good.
But there is an element of conspiracy, because when you're cooperating with your enemy as you're trying to kill them, it can be contrary to the purposes of war. And ultimately that's kind of where I get to, because if war, the function of war is to defeat your enemy, and that is the primary purpose, then does it make sense to place all these restrictions along the way if that is the goal? And these restrictions that can grow out of ad hoc, ad hoc practices or agreements, and including into international law, can actually constrain your ability to win a war and to fulfill the function of the war. And so in that sense, there is a conspiratorial element to it, even if sometimes unknowingly. Now, there are some explicit conspiracies when you get cooperation in warfare. I talk about the live and let live system that developed in World War I trenches. That is a straight up conspiracy. but in general, I think describing cooperation warfare as an attempt to try to civilize it is a big part of it. And you try to civilize war for a variety of reasons, mostly to constrain the damage of war in various ways, either the damage to your own soldiers, and then therefore you must enter into an agreement to accept, constraints, to the harm to enemy soldiers, attempts to constrain harm to civilians, constrain harm to your resources like your land, arable land and, water supplies and things like that. So a lot of it is to try to civilize war. It is, but not civilize it in the sense of making it orderly and not civilization in the sense of making it orderly and nice, but civilization for largely humanitarian purposes, for efficacy purposes, and also to try to make sense of this incredibly disturbing human activity, which is natural and pervasive and will probably never be eradicated. And I think a lot of the cooperation between enemies in warfare, at least a big portion of it, and I guess we'll talk about this more when we talk about fair fights, I guess, is an attempt to try to make sense of this barbaric activity that that warfighters are engaged in, that they have no access to, they have very little influence. Your warfighter on the ground or, at sea, has very little influence on whether your country has chosen to go to war, whether you're fighting, why you're fighting in this particular place at this particular time in this particular way. So they have no control over that, but they do have control over their immediate environment and how they engage in conflict with other people. And so, some of that cooperation is to try to generate a sense of meaning, or bring a sense of meaning to war by implementing certain rules for professional conduct. Try to cultivate warrior values so the activity they're engaged in, the immediate activity that they're engaged in, has purpose.
Right. I think of the these battles in the late modern period, where you have the soldiers all lined up in a huge row and they kind of march out into the field against one another. And, this is a sort of, as you say in the book, this is a sort of an artifact of late modern period. It's certainly not a necessary feature of it, but it's an example of how the way norms can be set up in order to organize war in a particularly meaningful way. And, you know, when soldiers would come upon enemy forces that didn't follow those rules, it's sort of deeply disturbing. And, you know, how dare they fight in different sorts of ways, right? I mean, but at the same time, I mean, this way of organizing war is extremely exceptional. You know, usually it's ugly and without rules and so forth and so on, right?
Mm-hmm. Yeah, that's exactly right. And I think it's something that's easy to forget, that the way that we fight wars now, with some, you know, desire for regulations and even international law. I mean, this is so outside the norm of human history. And it's frankly outside the norm of most of the way war is fought even today. Most war is still fought in a, you know, irregular style with guerrilla warfare, but we don't see it as much. It's harder to trace the narrative of a war in this way. And so you do naturally focus on what is easily, when you're talking about any event of any kind, you naturally focus on what is easy to describe and easy to plot out.
Yeah, and so we can say a little bit about the history here of warfare, which you go into in the first chapter, and this, expand on this point about the exceptional character of cooperation in war. I mean, I'm interested in, you know, sort of how it emerged in history, how it is that, you know, the two combatants can't resolve their differences through persuasion and have to resort to force, nevertheless are persuaded to govern their force through certain common norms. Like, that just seems to be, you know, a strange way, like how that would come about. So maybe you could just sort of walk through a little bit about the historical development of the general idea of cooperation in war.
Yeah, so I think probably an anthropologist would be much better placed to answer this question. I'll try to give a short version of it, which is that I think once you get societies, so I mean, there's disagreement over whether human beings are naturally violent, and whether war is a much, you know, and war, how common war is, whether that's kind of a natural state of being. I tend to fall into the camp of, you know, human beings being, or at least if they're not naturally violent, they certainly have they are very willing to be violent. They're naturally very willing to be violent under the right circumstances. And, you know, for most of human history, people have lived under those circumstances, which is basically of scarcity and competition over resources. But norms for warfare we see seem to have developed fairly early, partly because you have societies or smaller groups like tribes that are in constant contact with each other. And so, you know, over time, I think you see norms developed where you have groups who are going to have to fight with each other on a regular basis, but nobody is strong enough to be able to fully eliminate your competition, right? And so you're looking at long-term coexistence, and a rough kind of what I would describe as a Hobbesian parity, you know, and then so you have to develop norms and for mutual survival. And so this is why you see lots of very early development of ritualized warfare, which is war. There's certainly a lot of killing and damage, but the rituals have grown up in order to try to constrain the damages of war, because you know that everybody knows you have to fight again. maybe next week, maybe next month, maybe, certainly by next year. Right. And so that is how the norms, I think, as a broad historical narrative develop. And then you get, you know, specifically within particular societies, like, ancient Greek society or, you know, ancient classical Chinese society, then very particular norms, you know, for each with a fighting grow out of each society.
Yeah, and I can see, so the, you know, sort of Hobbesian account, which you broadly just sketched, I can see it as sort of, and the kind of game theoretic approach that you might think sort of emerges out of this kind of view that, you know, it's self-interest rightly understood in order to, you know, govern these conflicts because it's better for the interests of each party. I was also thinking and sort of inspired by some of the other comments that you make about it in the book about motivations for this. I mean, there's clearly, you know, might also say a moral motivation, mm-hmm. which we can talk about when we get to fair fights. But I also thought about this other feature of warfare that's governed by these norms, which is a norm of honor, mm-hmm. right? That, you know, it's in some cases it's not honorable to engage in the kind of bloody, chaotic fighting, that you need sort of a kind of structure, a set of rules in order for honor in war to manifest itself. It's like the example you use a little bit later in the book about sport athletic competitions, which are, you know, in the Greek context were preparations for war and were opportunities to display human excellence, right? Mm-hmm. So there's a sort of motive. I mean, I can see an account that would say setting these parameters can provide a kind of structure in which human beings can display honor. I don't know, what do you think about that?
I think that's a really important part of warfare. You're very right about that. Honor, I think, is in general a really important part of human society. It is one way in which you judge, you know, who is better, who is more worthy, who is going to receive more respect and goods of various kinds. And that's something that carries over into war, which is, you know, a significant activity in human society. So I think that's absolutely right. And honor especially becomes especially important in warfare because it is the, how do I want to put it? It's easily conferred in war. How you fight, how you kill, how successful you are on the battlefield is very translatable into a concept like a conferring honor, and it becomes wrapped up in the idea of what it means to be a warrior, and then it leads to distinctions between. Being a warrior and being somebody who kills in other ways, because there are certainly people who kill in a way related to kill in the context of a conflict who would not be considered warriors. And we could talk about assassins and snipers who are not always seen as warriors in war, versus a third category, which would be just somebody who murders, right?
I thought maybe you could say a little bit about your sort of intervention in the literature on just war theory, mm-hmm. Just kind of in general, because we'll talk about that a little bit later when we get to, sort of later chapter in your book. But rather, if you wanted to sort of situate your view in, you know, how you think about the existing way of thinking about war, it strikes me from reading your introductory chapter how just war theory has some issues these days. I mean, one of the things that you identify is the sort of religious baggage that some of the just war theory carries with it, and that there's a need to secularize mm-hmm. Just war theory. So maybe you could say a little bit about, you know, how you sort of see the ethics of cooperation sort of playing a role in the current literature on just war theory.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. So I think just war theory is enormously important. It has, it's done an enormous amount of work in trying to civilize, how we fight and to try to establish certain rules. Historically it's fascinating because if you're looking at traditional Christian just war theory, it was actually about justifying being able to go to war. It was an argument. It was trying to argue to pacifists, why they actually could fight and kill on behalf of, a god who should seem to ask for pacifism instead. But setting aside those origins, these rules about constraints for war have been really important. But some of my concern with traditional just war theory, as then translated into this contemporary period, is that they've taken these inherently religious principles and just basically stripped all the God out of it. And then now you have, you know, just secular versions of right intent and, you know, proper authority, discrimination, proportionality being used by most Western militaries, a lot of other militaries as well. And I think that's a good thing, because, you know, when you have no constraints at all, then that generates different problems. But I do think the principles themselves, when you just strictly secularize them, they do raise a lot of questions. There are some holes in this theory. One of the ones it's interesting to think about is, right intention. And intention in our contemporary context doesn't seem to matter all that much. What we're concerned about is justice and the rendering of justice. If justice is sometimes rendered for the wrong reasons, for people acting self-interestedly, is that a problem? Not so much in a secular context, but if you are concerned about warrior virtues, if you're concerned about moral injury to your warfighters, then maybe intent needs to come back into it. But intent in what way? And you can think about intent in a more religiously imbued way or a less religiously imbued way. And we haven't really addressed that problem. So I guess that's some of my general concern with just war theory. And then the other reason I wanted to write this book was that there's a lot that can both explain why we fight the way we do, and then also can point in a normative direction for maybe how we should think about warfare that can't be explained by just war theory. And this is where I started to see all of this, certain types of cooperation and forming that I think it explains a significant part of how we fight. It explains a significant part of our normative expectations for warfare. And then I started to seeing the ways in which, just war theory and what I call this ethic of cooperation, in warfare can come into conflict, where, for example, when, the demands of military necessity in a just war, from a just war theory perspective, may come into conflict with demands for civilian immunity in an ethic of, cooperation perspective. So there are some potential tensions there, which we haven't really worked out. And on the other hand, in the context of war, maybe they will never be resolved, but we should be aware of those tensions.
I'm just trying to get your nail down, how your project is related to a project of developing a just war theory. So is the idea that, you're developing an ethic of cooperation that's sort of one normative piece of the puzzle, what would be an effect of a more complete just war theory, right? It's like, it's one ethical value that would have to be balanced against others. Is that the right way to think about it? How it fits in with this sort of more comprehensive theory about normative theory about war.
Right. Yes. And in a couple of specific ways. So, one is, part of the purpose, and this is why I spend so much time talking about, history in this book, is that I'm interested in the genealogy of warfare, and because I think that tells us a lot about how we think about war. And the reason the genealogy matters is because it does shape our normative expectations. And so I think if you come at it from a purely philosophical perspective and say, well, this is what just war theory demands, and this is what we expect out of war. I think that's the approach that when ethics is taught in contemporary militaries, for the most part, that is how it's done. It's kind of this abstract thing that comes out of nowhere. Here are the norms. You must obey them. But they don't explain a lot of the places in which we have trouble with certain types of war. And I guess we'll talk at the end about terrorism and the ways in which that, our trouble, our difficulty with figuring out what to do with terrorism, both in a practical political and normative sense, comes out of a lack of understanding of how much cooperative norms have influenced the way we think about the ethics of war. And so if you're only looking at just war theory and you're trying, if you're only using just war theory, traditional just war theory to figure out what to do with terrorism, you're not going to get very satisfying answers. And I think that's what has been happening so far. Whereas if you then come at it from this perspective of, oh, here's this framework of the ethic of cooperation and how has that shaped the international institutions as they exist, our expectations for, what qualifies as legitimate warfare, then suddenly that both explains a lot of the trouble that we have in dealing with contemporary terrorism, and also perhaps points a way to maybe some ways of trying to resolve these difficulties. So that's part of it. And then the other thing, I forgot to say a little earlier was the other intervention into just war theory that I was interested in was this disagreement between traditional just war theorists and revisionists, over the moral equality of combatants. Do combatants on either side of this conflict, do they have equal moral rights to fight and to defend themselves, regardless of the justice of their cause? And, traditionally we think, at least now, we think combatants have moral equality. And so if you are fighting an unjust war for an unjust government, you're not held personally responsible for that injustice. So you are permitted to fight, you're permitted to kill, you're permitted in the proper war context of war, and you're permitted to defend yourself in that context. But revisionists say that combatants are not morally equal, that if you are fighting on behalf of an unjust cause, you do not have the same rights. And one of the things I wanted to point out was that, that may be normatively correct. Let's just assume that is normatively correct. But then there are all sorts of implications of that may be difficult for people to accept, both practically and politically and philosophically, and that these difficulties may be better explained by this ethic of cooperation and warfare than they would be by just war theory.
Now, to jump into the meat of the book, you talk in three different chapters about three different main forms of cooperation and warfare, and that they're in the form of three different purposes that two different sides would cooperate. Why they would cooperate? One is to set up a fair fight, which is interesting. The second one is to minimize damage to particularly civilians. And the third is to set up norms to end war quickly to avoid lots of destruction. And I thought we could take each one because there are lots of great things in each one. So the first one is setting up a fair fight. To draw on this analogy from sports, which you draw on in this chapter, I think is good, which is that, like what you have in sports, we want our sporting events to be in some sense a fair competition. It's not very enjoyable, even for spectators or for the participants themselves, to have a wildly lopsided competition or one in which, both sides sort of repeatedly cheat, don't follow the rules. So we want to govern these competitions by certain rules, official rules or even informal norms. I remember, long ago when I was in Little League, there was an informal norm not to drive up the score, right? When you're like playing against other, six-year-olds, we don't want to get totally crush their spirits and make them cry, right? So, there's informal norms at work there. Maybe we could start, there's sort of the analogy with sports that you draw on and sort of draw out, what you mean by a fair fight in war and how it operates there.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, so I think, I wanted to use the sports and analogy partly because people, militaries use sports analogies. And as you mentioned earlier, original sporting events were all inspired by military activities, right? And so it is a way in which the military thinks, and vice versa. People who play sports, if you listen to sportscasters, they're just constantly using military analogies as well. So I think the concept of fairness and what constitutes a fair fight is it's pretty amorphous. Nobody has it written down anywhere, and like we talked about, most of war is totally unfair. And nobody is interested in having a fair fight. It's just completely contrary to the purpose of war. On the other hand, you do get all these repeated instances of a desire for a certain type of fairness. And in looking at all these different examples and in looking at how it plays out in sports as well, I think what is driving it is this desire for it's kind of equitable opportunity. To think about fairness as equitable opportunity, to think about parity within a certain range. And so in your example, of Little League, right? You don't want to drive up the score. What happens when you drive up the score? It makes it really obvious that the other team is a lot worse than yours. And nobody likes that in a competition. And there's a sense that if you are going to compete, it should actually be competitive. There should actually be a possibility that the other side can come through and win. And not just this, complete long shot, Hail Mary possibility, but that the two sides are, if not roughly equally matched, at least within the, striking distance of each other, such that it is worthwhile to play the game. Because that's the whole point of having a sporting competition, is that on any given day, anybody can win. And that's what makes it exciting. But if you have, two teams that are playing, one of them is winning 75 to three, then suddenly you're looking at a situation which is really obvious that, frankly, the other side will never win. They are so bad that there's no possibility, even if they got extremely lucky, that they will ever win. And nobody's interested in a competition like that. And so that's kind of what the fairness, when I talk about fairness of this type in sports, and then as it manifests in war, that's what they're interested in, is kind of a rough, at least this opportunity to win. And in war, it means an opportunity to fight back, and potentially be able to kill you instead.
Yeah, and I thought we could maybe dig into a couple examples if you're game with this. I mean, one of your examples is about snipers, which I was wondering about that, because so snipers, you might think in one way it's not a fair fight, right? Mm-hmm. I mean, a sniper is sort of hidden in a building far away, and that other side can't fight back. And I gather from your book is that at one point snipers were regarded as sort of cowardly, or that they're not engaged in a fair fight. But I take it that norm has somewhat changed over time, right? We tend to regard snipers more as, as necessary part of the important part of the military, sort of standard feature. So I guess maybe you say a little bit about snipers and like how they fit into this, and maybe to talk about a little bit about how fairness of it has changed over time or not. I don't know.
So with snipers, it's to go back to this, what you were talking about in the beginning about honor, right? I mean, war, in the beginning, it was all at close range. You had hand to hand combat. You had, short range weapons like swords, and there is a certain amount of honor in fighting this way, or it becomes imbued with honor, right? And becomes imbued with meaning to be able to fight and prevail in these situations. But at the same time, war is not, the fight itself is not the ultimate goal of the activity. The ultimate goal of the activity is to win. And so you get this tension between certain ways in which you can demonstrate warrior prowess and earn warrior honor, but also the impetus to win, which which is to kill the other person without being killed. And it's always easier to do that if you're putting distance between yourself and the opponent. And so that's why you get bows and arrows and weapons that that put distance between you and the enemy. And so so in the history of warfare, there's always this tension of trying to put more distance between you and the enemy, right? But also fighting in certain honorable ways. And so snipers are kind of, snipers are not unique. I mean, snipers are a very powerful symbol of this, but they're not, that phenomenon is not unique. And, there's the famous Battle of Agincourt where, the English use these longbows, right? And so snipers are just, they're another version of that. They're the modern version of this. And they are, seen as cowardly because they don't get into the fight. And it is seen as being unfair because they're hidden from the enemy in a way that, other soldiers are not. And specifically because they're taking shots at an enemy that has no idea that the sniper is there. And then so, there's some of the stories that I reference are really, famous ones, and Walter used them as well in his famous book. They're all examples of people who are basically enjoying normal things in life in the midst of war. They're having coffee. They're smelling the wildflowers. They're smoking a cigarette, and they have no idea that somebody is, has their sights trained on them and could kill them at any moment. And so this seems grossly unfair to the fighters for two reasons. One is there is that distance, and there is this lack of knowledge that you are being targeted and that you cannot fight back. You have no opportunity to win. And so this gets into the problem with the idea of fairness as equitable opportunity to fight, as parity within a range. Here you have, the other person has no opportunity at all. They are not, on par with you. And then the other is this, the other reason snipers are abhorred is that they're not subject to the same randomness that everybody else is. And so when you're on, when you're engaged in a ground battle, there is a lot of randomness to war. Who gets killed, who survives, who's going to win on the day. And there's something about that randomness that then makes things seem more fair because everybody is subject to it. But with a sniper, they're not subject to it. They're removed from the immediate battlefield, and they personally get to choose who is going to die in this moment. And that seems to a lot of people incredibly unfair. Now, that perception has changed a little bit. In recent years, we've had, I think partly because over time, people have recognized that, despite their uneasiness with using snipers, they're very effective. again, there's this tension between what your immediate goals and values and virtues that you want to promote in the battle and your overall goal in the war, which is to win. And this is what I talk about at some point about the tension between battle function and war function, right? It's analogous to that. So despite all of the discomfort with snipers and hatred of snipers, people recognize they are useful. They're incredibly effective. And then so you do get some, there are a couple of recent movies that have glorified snipers. But overall, there's still this, there is still this sense that there's something, they're not engaged in war the same way most other people are necessarily.
Right. There's less of a, putting oneself at risk, right? Mm-hmm. That I think of this in the context of the drone pilots, right? Mm-hmm. Who are another kind of, yet another iteration of a form of technology that allows combatants to shield themselves from the risk of war, mm-hmm. which seems to move away from a fair fight. And the kind of, you know, those drone pilots and the way you hear about how they have this kind of inner conflict about, I think, picking up on what you say in the book, that, you know, soldiers need to feel that they're not just, that they're different than murderers, right? And it's sometimes difficult to tell that to yourself when you're, you know, in a bunker thousands of miles away from the combat. You just push a button, somebody's dead when they're sitting on the toilet or something. I mean, it's in some way a fair fight is necessary in order to, you know, give some kind of moral meaning to one's own identity, right?
Right. Yeah. And perhaps counterintuitively, you know, some of these, I mean, raises all sorts of questions of, you know, are these drone pilots even on what qualifies? Are they even on the battlefield, given how far away they are? And the fact that they go home to their spouses and children at the end of the day, there's an internal tension within the military as well, disagreement about how honorable this is, how meritorious a drone fighter is, or drone pilot is. And you know, ironically, it's, you know, interestingly, one of the perks of being a drone pilot is that you can go home to your family at the end of the day and live a very normal life, but it does take a psychological toll. I suspect that, you know, there are at least some cases of drone pilots who would rather, they'd rather be in a situation that's much more like a regular deployment, because it would put their work more obviously into a wartime context. And I think psychologically that may be, that would, for at least some of them, would be easier. There would be less cognitive dissonance that they would have to deal with in the context of their jobs, if they could be deployed in a kind of regular way.
Yeah, I mean, this just seems, you know, there's sort of an ineradicable tension that it seems that you're pointing to, and I don't know if I quite have put my finger on it, but a kind of tension. I mean, in some ways, it's a tension between a deontological ethical approach and a consequentialist ethical approach, right? There's a deontological commitment to obey certain kinds of norms of fairness in war, but yet there's also a commitment to get the right consequences, which is to, like, reduce your casualties and win the war. And those might be in tension with one another. If you give up drones or give up snipers, then you're not guaranteeing victory, and that could be bad. Is that the right way to think about what you're getting at here? I mean, this is a form of cooperation, but it's always balanced against a more consequentialist ethic in the calculation of thinking about war.
Mm-hmm. Yes, I think actually that's a really good way of putting it. I'm not sure that I do that in the book, but I think that's a great way of describing it, that you do have, there is a desire to be fair. That is, you know, that is a virtue, to act with honor, in certain ways, but you're always running up against, the demands of war. And what is the demand for is to win so that you can then achieve your geopolitical goal. Right. But along the way, right, there are consequences. There are different levels of consequences that you're interested in. And there are also different levels of, deontological demands that you're interested in. And so, in both cases, the example of civilians fall into both categories very nicely, right? You can also want to minimize the number of civilians you kill for both consequential and deontological reasons. But that then can, you know, cut against your other, you know, the other demands in the context of war. And so there is this constant tension. And especially, you know, with sniping and with targeted killings, with drone warfare now, the big tension is how much harm are you sparing civilians, but at the cost of being seen as fighting unfairly. right? And how much does that matter? And so despite the fact that most people do not fight fair in war, most people never have and most people never will, there is an expectation. And it's, you know, and not just amongst not just amongst people in the military, but amongst civilians as well, right? There's an indignation when war, when something seems to be unfair. And certainly a targeted killing that is, you know, launched, that is commanded from 7,000 miles away seems grossly unfair. but at the same time, a targeted killing may be much better, from a consequentialist approach, be a much better way to go about things, because you're not putting as many civilians at risk, as you are with a ground invasion to accomplish your same purposes. So now you're stuck in this dilemma of, I'm probably saving more civilian lives. And now this is controversial. There's certainly disagreement about targeted drone killings and how, and the harm to civilians that they cause. I think the evidence is pretty strong that they do save civilian lives, but you have to compare it to what would be the alternative, right? Alternative would be a ground invasion. But so I'll acknowledge that there's disagreement about that. But if you just grant me the assumption that targeted killings and snipings do less collateral damage to civilians, then this is a good thing. But, being seen as fighting unfairly is, can do you, the military with the drone capabilities, a lot of damage in the long run in terms of legitimacy and goodwill with the population.
I'm sort of getting it now. If you were, to evaluate the normative value of drone killing, I'm assuming from your book, it looks like, there's a kind of pluralistic way of looking at this, that there are various incommensurable considerations here, right? That drone killings might not be fair, so that's a knock against them, but they might lead to the war having a shorter outcome, which is your third point. We'll get to it in a minute. But they might or may not lead to more civilian casualties, and that's an open question. So for each of these things, this is going to your historical contextualization feature of your book, which I find so useful, that you need to take account of these different sort of purposes in order to get a fuller picture of the ethics of these different kind of modes of war. Is that right? Am I on the right track there?
Yeah. No, I think that's a really great way of putting it. That there are lots of different. There are a lot of different forces at work here, and you do have to make sense of them. You do have to tease them out and separate them from each other in order to understand, basically, in order to be able to make a decision, right, about how you're going to approach it. Because ultimately, if it is a conflict between fighting fair and saving civilian lives, I would come down on if I were a military, if I were making military policy, I would come down on the side of saving civilian lives, even if you're being perceived as fighting unfairly. Is that maybe what the civilians in question would want? I don't know. Maybe not. But that's the decision. That's a decision that I would make on their behalf. But in order to make that decision, you have to be able to separate out all these different factors and decide what your values are. As a society with the kind of society you're in, with the kind of military you have, and then be able to defend the decisions that you make.
Yeah, I imagine this is a difficult moral a calculation to make, because it might be in the short run, better for saving civilian lives to have drone strikes, but it might be in the long run, like, way worse for civilian lives if it creates a system in which it just perpetuates more suicide bombings on the other side and so forth.
And there's no question there are a lot of costs to being to fighting in certain ways that are perceived as unfair, a lot of serious long-term costs.
This reminds me of Kant, which a lot of things remind me of Kant. So Maybe this is because I want to ask you about this, about your relationship to Kant in general. But so maybe this is a point to ask about this, because, you know, Kant and perpetual peace, as in their preliminary articles, talks about how, you know, we shouldn't commit assassination, we shouldn't spy on one another, we shouldn't do all these things that lead to an unfair fight, because it's morally abhorrent, right? I mean, it doesn't fulfill, you know, the principle of publicity. It doesn't fulfill the categorical imperative, whatever. Mm-hmm. I mean, also, you know, part of what's in the background here is that these, you know, in a consequentialist fashion, they don't lead to perpetual peace for Kant either, right? That these are methods for undermining trust among nations, where you want to lead towards a condition in which they can trust one another. So it seems to me that, you know, Kant is largely sort of in your camp. I was wondering what you feel like you draw from Kant, where you maybe depart from Kant.
Mm-hmm.
Big question, I know. You could focus on the perpetual peace, not on the Critique of Pure Reason, for example.
Right. That would also assume that I understand Kant, which I would never claim to do. So I guess a couple of things, I guess more immediately, you know, in the context of this fair fight, is that the Kant is interested in, he's actually also interested in the development of martial virtues, which a lot of people find surprising and disturbing. And he sees some value in them. But the key for Kant, I think, is that he's not interested in martial virtues for their own sake. He thinks that they can be part of the set of virtues that are necessary for ultimately, establishing peaceful governance, lawful autonomy, both individually and for republics. And this is why he's so adamant about placing certain limitations on war, you know, like you mentioned, no assassinations or spying, that you have to pursue, even as you are killing other people, you have to pursue war in a fashion that is conducive to developing self-governance. Peaceful self-governance and peaceful, coexistence with other societies that are self-governing. And so that is what places the limitations on warfare. And so I think that's related to this, to the fair fight, the idea of a fair fight in a fundamental way, because I think a lot of the concern with fair fights amongst war fighters themselves is exactly that fear that if you fight in certain ways, you dishonor yourself, but more specifically, you do damage to yourself. And this is what, we call moral injury, right? It will then ultimately affect your sense of morality, your sense of right and wrong, and you have crippled yourself as a human being, in a significant way. And the ability to make moral judgments is essential for human beings. And so I think that this concern with the fair fight, like a warrior concern with a fair fight, dovetails really nicely with Kant's concern about. Certain types of limiting the fighting of war in certain ways for the purpose of being able to, establish self-governance at a later date. I think that's, Kant here is very relevant. I think Kant is also, specifically with perpetual peace and the idea of more broadly, Kant's idea of perpetual peace is that eventually, when all societies, as societies become more and more republican, you will have fewer and fewer wars between each other. And I think that becomes really interesting because you can imagine, because if you think about, what makes cooperation and warfare possible, right? Cooperation between enemies and warfare possible, some of it is common language, not necessarily, but some of it is shared culture, not necessarily, but certainly the ability to trust, right? And if you, which Kant talks about, if you get into the situation in which societies who are able to trust each other, you know, over time fight each other less, then the societies that don't trust each other will still continue to fight. But if they don't trust each other, then you will be also be unable to cooperate, you know, engage in the kind of cooperation I'm talking about during war. That may make the wars between them both more frequent and more violent and more damaging. And so that is kind of a I don't know if it rises to the level of irony, but that is one of the, I think that's one of the implications of perpetual peace that we should think about as well.
Yes, yeah, that's great. Just in the interest of time, to move on to the second point that you made, a second form of cooperation that you talk about, which is cooperation to shield civilians, shield medical personnel, shield leaders. This is quite an interest. I mean, this is a sort of well-known form, and it's institutionalized in various ways that you point out through, like, the use of uniforms, for example. But you also bring out the complications with this, because it's not always clear that it's how to identify civilians or how to disentangle them from military personnel and any circumstances. And, you know, in the case of medical personnel, the advances in medical technology, it's medical personnel can help an army considerably. It's not just a remedial effort. So maybe you could talk about this form of cooperation and the sort of challenges that's faced in upholding it.
Yeah. So the second category is about, you know, cooperating to protect certain classes of people. And what's interesting is that you get all these different classes of people that are being protected for very different reasons. Civilians, you know, is because there is this concept of civilian immunity, and which is itself is problematic, you know, not especially in modern societies in which there's enormous division of labor, but also, you know, a lot of integration of the economy, right? The kind of easy categories of civilian and military are not, they're difficult to pull apart. But so it becomes what I call a functional fiction, right? You know, we all know that civilians aren't wholly innocent, military isn't wholly guilty, but you have to choose. you must create categories when you're in a situation like this. And then so, you know, what you want to do is try to put as many people in the immune category as possible. But you protect POWs. There's been collaboration to protect POWs for entirely different reasons. And then a lot of that has to do with this, a lot of the current POW protections, what we're used to now is the idea of POWs, they're being held in, you know, detention afterwards and, you know, treated reasonably well. You're supposed to treat them reasonably well. And then afterwards they are released and not held responsible for going to war. They're only held responsible for, you know, war crimes if they committed any. But the very act of going to war is not their responsibility. This is, and being held in a detention camp like this where they are not accountable for the political decisions is also fairly recent. And that's part of a broader phenomenon about the way we think about war and what its purpose is. And then protections for political leaders is all about creating that kind of stability where you can negotiate peace afterwards, right, and maintain enough trust to be able to do that successfully. But, you know, so the category of medics is really interesting because there's, you know, medics are considered to be immune on the battlefield. You're not supposed to kill them. They're supposed to be adequate. They display their adequate markings. You're supposed to leave them alone. And the trade-off of that for that is that medics are supposed to be neutral. They are supposed to equally attend to everybody that they find. You know, even if you are the medic of belonging to a, you know, to a particular national army. So, you know, makes sense. The Red Cross will treat everybody that they find. But an American, you know, military doctor, or, you know, a Russian military doctor, or any other military, you know, doctor of a belonging to a national military, and there are plenty of them, are also supposed to treat everybody equally, including their enemies. And then, and this is, so that is the price of their immunity. But what's interesting is that I think the function of a medic has changed over time, along with advances in technology. And now you're not just, you know, part of the reason you left medics alone before was because they were just trying to save a person's life on the battlefield. That person is probably too injured to be able to meaningfully fight again, you know, in the near future. And so, you know, there's no point in killing them or letting them die if their lives can be saved, because that doesn't serve the function of the battle, right? Doesn't serve the you know, to winning the battle. They're already out of, you know, they're out of combat effectively. But with modern tech, modern medicine, modern technology, you can actually not just save a warfighter's life, but you can send them back into battle. Now, most of the time that doesn't happen, right? But sometimes it does. And, you know, in small percentage of cases, or you can use them for other functions in the military. Now you have large bureaucratic militaries, they can perform other jobs. And so, you know, medics aren't just, they're not just engaged in simple humanitarian missions anymore. They're actually engaged in salvage, which is to, you know, basically repurpose these, you know, your resources for reuse. And this time the resource is a human life, you know, human capital. So that then makes, you know, the idea of medical neutrality and medical immunity just a little more problematic, because they are serving a clear military function. They are a force multiplier. They do allow, you know, and if you have a very good medical team, you know, militaries will take more risks. They will be a little more aggressive because they, you know, they can be more confident that they can be, you know, rescued and healed and, you know, return to something resembling a normal life. And so they do have military purpose. And so it does raise questions about whether medics should be immune. And this is something that is, you know, I mean, instinctively, if you say this is, I mean, you know, people recoil. This is absolutely morally abhorrent. How can you say that doctors, you know, might be subject, you know, to targeting in a battle? But from the perspective of battle function, you have to ask that question nowadays.
Yeah, I was reading your chapter, and when the news came out about this Iranian scientist who was the head of the nuclear program there was assassinated. Looks like from you know, Israeli forces, and I was thinking about that in this context because this, scientists are also, you know, civilians, right? They're sort of shouldn't be targeted, but here's a case in which one was, and I, you know, I don't know what you think about that. I mean, is that, how would you examine that under the ethic of cooperation here? This is not a matter of cooperation, clearly, but this is someone who's pursuing, according to the justification, I guess one would give, is someone's pursuing something that could potentially be a huge security threat for Israel.
Yeah, that is, it is such a difficult question. And I mean, so I think you have to ask the same questions about the scientists. So I'm going to admit, I'm going to punt just a little bit on this question.
Oh, that's okay. Yeah, no, I just sprung this one on you.
Yeah, no, but it's interesting. It's a really important question, and I think you have to ask about the science. But I think you have to ask about the scientist. You have to ask about them the same way you ask about political leaders, because I mean, part of, you know, one of the things that I keep hitting in this book is, you know, that the people who make, at least in, you know, certainly in modern war, where there is, you know, you have these massive armies, you have, you know, professional soldiers, and you have, especially when in societies where there's civilian supremacy over the military, you know, there is a clear deficit of accountability and for decisions to go to war, decisions that end up killing a lot of people amongst the, you know, the political leadership. And I think you can ask, and so the question is what to do about it, right? You know, and, you know, like we talked about, there's an interest in maintaining a certain, in maintaining certain levels of trust. And this is why you want to forbid assassinations. You want to maintain a certain level of trust between societies so that they can negotiate peace afterwards. One of the ways of doing that is to not go around, you know, killing all of their political leaders, which, you know, we could all do. But there's a cost to that, right? Which means that those who make the decisions to go to war, those who make the decisions that end up in a lot of deaths, are very rarely held responsible. And which means that they also then, you know, are incentivized to make a lot of bad decisions. and this is something Kant also talks about. So, and I think you can ask the same questions of the scientists, right? If they're engaged in certain types of activities, that are, that contribute to war efforts, that contribute to, you know, rise in conflict, then, you know, how can they be held responsible? In an ideal world, you know, there'd be something available. there'd be a more established process for doing that. But we do, you know, still live in a fundamentally anarchic international world, and then so the only types of, you know, regular, the accountability in our international institutions are not, you know, they're. You know, like the Hague or, you know, the International Criminal Court, don't have as much power and influence as, you know, perhaps you would want for a situation like this. And so what do? People resort to assassinations, right? So that's one way of looking at it, that it's a question of accountability for war activities. The other way of looking at it is actually going back to the question of who's a civilian and who's in the military, and therefore, and who actually gets civilian immunity. Because my guess is that, you know, if Israel did this, that the argument that they could put forth an argument saying, well, you know, if he's working on nuclear weapons, then he's not a civilian. He's involved, you know, in the military apparatus. He's been improperly classified as a civilian, and, you know, and if you think of him as being a member of the military, then he is a fair target. So this case is a really fascinating case, because I think you can ask a lot of questions about it from a lot of different angles, from the perspective of cooperation, right? We have to agree on what's a civilian and who's a civilian and who's not. And clearly Israel is pushing the boundaries of that agreement with this, because he is under standard understanding, the scientist was a civilian. So there's that question. And then there's the other question about, you know, accountability and our lack of, our international inability to hold people accountable for war-related decisions.
Is it fair to say that it's becoming just increasingly difficult as we speed ahead here into late modernity to uphold this ethic of cooperation, just in the sense, I mean, we were talking about it in the terms of a fair fight. I mean, it's just difficult to uphold these norms, you know, in this particular kinds of war settings that we find ourselves with, the kind of technology that we have. Mm-hmm. It's also increasingly difficult to uphold the cooperative norms of shielding civilians, because it's difficult to know who is a civilian and who's not, that, you know, the these things becoming increasingly blurred. Like, in other words, it was easier to maintain these norms in kind of an earlier modern period, but that over time it seems like it's becoming increasingly difficult. Do you agree with that, or is that too pessimistic?
So I do and I don't. So I guess I think you're right, that as you get, as modern societies become more complex, then these boundaries become more blurred. For that reason, it is more difficult. It's more difficult to uphold the norms, partly because it's more difficult to figure out what the norms are demanding of you. Like in this case, you know, with the scientist, right? But there, But I think partly, I think it's actually, it's not that it's, but there's another phenomenon working at the same time, which is that it's not entirely that it's more difficult to uphold these norms, but that our expectations for warfare have just exploded exponentially in the past few centuries. And I think it's easy to think it's, again, because, you know, we're understandably concerned with present wars, right? And with our expectations for these, and I think we can forget that the expectations for how we fight wars have just become so much more demanding over time, and so then there becomes this disconnect between the pace of the expectations, of rising expectations, and then the pace of our ability to meet those expectations. I think there's just this bigger and bigger gap between that, and so it's not that we're doing a worse job of it's not necessarily that we're doing a worse job of cooperating or a worse job of, you know, say, protecting civilians, for example, if that's one of our goals of cooperation. It's just that our expectations have risen so quickly, and that we've never met those expectations in the past, but it's just now the gap between achievement and expectation is so much higher. And then there's also just the question of scale. Globalization makes a difference, right? And in the past, you know, the further back you go, the fewer people you'd be expected to cooperate with, because your reach was much, you didn't have as far of a reach when you're fighting a war. You know, back in the hoplite days, you could fight a war with the people you could march to. You know, it's a, you know, a few hundred miles distance. But now you can fight a war with anybody, anywhere in the world, pretty much, for a lot of the for the most advanced militaries. And so you're being asked to cooperate on a much grander scale with a lot more people, and that raises the expectations, and it also raises the expectations for cooperation, but also raises the complexity of cooperation.
Yeah, that seems quite right. I mean, I like that, the way that you phrased that, the expectations are higher, but it's harder to meet those expectations. I mean, the expectations are quite high. I mean, there's lots of international norms and international laws that govern war now. And I think of the way in which these international norms are expressed, say, in Syria, when was that? Bashar al-Assad used poison gas or biological weapons against his own people at that one moment. And the kind of international outcry that occurred after that. I mean, it's sort of an expression of the demand, the expectations there. But as you say, at the same time, the difficulties of meeting is quite high. The other element that I was going to throw on the table, just to, you know, in the interest of moving on to the third form of cooperation, which is cooperation to end wars quickly, which is, you know, it's great. You talk about pitched battles that end wars quickly, and the duels and trials by combat that appeal to the heavens, which is great. One of the things that that occurs to me in thinking about this and the general question I just asked you a minute ago about the difficulties of achieving cooperation is a lot of the norms here were undergirded by religious norms in the past, especially the kind of the ritual combat that you feel free to talk about here, you know, like the David and Goliath kind of situation where you have two combatants who, you know, instead of the whole armies fighting, you have your two best combatants who would fight against one another, and that would resolve the battle. Well, you know, one of the things that often occurred to me in thinking about this is, well, why would, if a side loses, why would it give up? You know, you might just say, well, okay, that was just Goliath that lost. Now the Philistines are going to overrun the Israel. So why do they obey it? Well, there's a kind of religious element here that you're held to account. And with secularized society, you wonder if there's an effect of the loss of those religious norms that undergird these norms of collaboration.
Mm-hmm. That's really interesting. I think there's something to that. I mean, well, I guess with the religious, actually, I was thinking with the, so you could view, and this is part of the whole trial by combat thing, right? That the winner is, is the one that God has chosen. And then so you'd accept the outcome because, well, you know, there's a higher, force adjudicating this. And so you're more likely to accept the outcome. I was thinking about the contrast. I wonder if actually that is that, I mean, you know, the Iliad is, who knows how much of the Iliad is actually true. But this dual battle in the Iliad that fails, right, between Paris and Menelaus, they agree to this, Paris loses, but then the explanation is he's whisked away, right? And so, you know, in real life, what would have it look like? It would look like, you know, Paris ran away. But you could still look at it from a religious perspective because you can say, oh, well, actually, in this case, there are gods and they are adjudicating this, but because it's polytheistic and there are multiple gods, they disagree with each other. And then so we actually don't know what the gods want because they're still fighting it out. It's interesting. I hadn't thought about that.
It could cut either way. It could uphold collaborative norms more in a monotheistic setting, polytheistic setting. It could, you know, challenge cooperative norms.
Right. So, yeah, I mean, there is something about the loss of that, the loss of that higher adjudicating power. And then you then have to sign on to just the process itself. And that becomes more difficult, when the more significant your goal is, right? If your goal is seizing somebody else's crops and maybe a tiny bit of territory for this year, then, you know, if you lose, maybe, you know, then the costs are not so high of conceding. But if your goal is, protecting your entire way of life in your society, because if you lose, the other party is going to come in and remake your entire society and enslave you, then I could see how the procedure alone is not going to get buy-in without the religious element, reinforcing it. So, and that is one of the, there are many advantages of, you know, a secular modern world, but that is certainly one of the costs, I would think.
Yeah, so can you say a bit about this cooperation to end wars quickly? You know, you have this great example of the Greek hoplites who had this cooperative norm to have these pitched battles that would end very quickly. I'm also interested in these trial by combat, and you suggest there are ways in which, you know, there's those sort of modern analogs of them. So you could speak to that.
Yeah. So the hoplite example, I love it because it's so weird, but yet resonates because, you know, aesthetically, it's something that I think modern Western militaries are really deeply influenced by. And so, yeah, these classical Greek hoplites who, they fought in phalanx formation and they would go to war with each other on a fairly regular basis. I mean, every summer, right? But this was still classical Greece, and there was mostly, these hoplite armies are made up of small farmers and who were incredibly busy most of the year, you know, with planting, harvesting, and everything else. And so they didn't have a lot of time to fight, but they had to fight. So they would fight in basically, you know, when they did fight, it was very short, a few hours, maybe a day at the most. And on the battlefield, there were no rules. You could do anything you want. But at the end, but it became obvious, you know, after a few hours, usually who won. And then basically it was over. Everybody went home. You collected your spoils and you went home. Casualties were probably, casualties weren't low, about 15% deaths, 20% casualties overall, but because they weren't fighting that often and they weren't, and the war really was just a single battle, you can sustain casualties like that, which is really different from a modern war with repeated pitch battles. So, so what's interesting about this is that you did have this cooperation in an entirely different way. So this kind of cooperation is different from the other types, because you're not cooperating about what you do when you're fighting. You're cooperating about the structure of the war, that you do, meet in some kind of you know, there wasn't a predetermined place or anything, but you do meet on a battlefield. You do fight for a short, you know, period of time, and then you accept the outcome. And the consequences of losing were not so high, right? It wasn't your entire society was destroyed. It was you lose some property, and you lose some people. So, and you live again to fight next year, which you undoubtedly will. So, this was being driven by scarcity, a scarcity of time and scarcity of resources. But it was also made possible by the fact that you had, you know, these Greek societies were all very similar. And so they could settle on fighting in this way, which is also kind of ironic because, you know, one of the Persian commentators says, well, actually, given that these societies are similar and they speak the same language and they can communicate with each other, they shouldn't fight at all. Why are they doing this? They should settle their conflicts in a different way. But at least they found a way to fight limited battles. So this is an aesthetic. The idea of this pitched, you know, decisive battle that determines everything, right? This is an aesthetic that that carries over into modern Western views of war. But what you get, my concern with these modern views is that you get all of this, you get the pitch battle, you get the lack of any kinds of regulations or restrictions on fighting, on the fighting itself, but you get none of the cooperation in the modern period. And that's devastating. And that's what leads actually to, what we're used to now, which is wars that last for years. and sustained casualty rates at levels that would have wiped out entire societies back in the classical period. But because you've lost this cooperative element of, this cooperative agreement about the boundaries of war, about the battle being decisive, that we get this modern problem, and combined with the technological advances. So that's kind of the cooperation end word quickly. And then the relationship to trial by combat is in the modern period, you also get you get a lot of shifts in why people fight wars over time, right? And for a long time you fought wars for not just to acquire property, but also for religious reasons. James Whitman has this very interesting book about the purposes of war and the ways in which they change over time. And so he talks about, in the 18th century, wars became the purview of these, became a public activity. They were waged by monarchs rather than being waged privately by aristocrats. And they were really waged over property. it was about acquiring more land and more resources. People engaged in what was, what he called the wager theory of battle, right? You accepted the outcome of the war. There was a trial by combat element to it because, people imbued a lot of religious significance to the winner of the war. But then things change a little over time, right? Wars become more scientific. There's a lot more military science. And then you think, I don't have to actually take this chance. I don't have to make a gamble. I don't have to gamble on war. I can guarantee my win. And then wars also become more ideological, right? They're fought less over the acquisition of property. I mean, it's all, all these motives are mixed together, but a lot of it then becomes about questions of questions about governance, questions of the form of governance. And then people start to lose the idea of, they start rejecting the idea that a pitched, the outcome of a pitched battle is somehow decisive, right? And Whitman says, the turning point, one of the major turning points is the American Civil War, where the South in the beginning won several pitched battles, and they thought that was going to be enough to win the war. And it turns out it wasn't. It turns out the North, decided to keep fighting. But I think, the trial by combat idea persists uh, in in modern day, in the structure of the modern, of contemporary international law, because contemporary international law is so focused on use in bello regulations. It's so focused on restricting what you can or cannot do during war. And it says very little about what qualifies as a just war. The only thing that, you know, that the international law says is in the UN Charter is that you cannot threaten or use force against, an independent to acquire territory or against an independent political entity, right? That's it. So it basically says, basically says all of our existing boundaries are acceptable, all the existing situation, it's a time slice principle. Our existing situation, the status quo is acceptable. Nothing else is, and we're only going to talk about, what you can or can't do during war. So what's interesting is that the more we care, basically in the past, century or, past couple centuries, the more that we have cared about justice, and rendering justice with war, the less that we have governed, the less we've governed questions of the justice of war, the more we've governed justice during war and during fighting. And so you leave all these questions about the justice of war unanswered. And so in that sense, contemporary warfare as institutionalized, within the international law is like trial by combat. We kind of assume that who wins the war is the just party, not in any kind of religious sense, but they won, and so because they won, we get certain boundaries in certain places, and that is what we need to stick with.
Well, I think that's a great place to end. There's just so much more in the book. I wish we had a chance to get to, but I encourage everybody to read it. Let me just say at the end here, thank you so much, Yvonne, for joining me on the Political Theory Review.
Thank you so much for having me. This is a really great conversation. And loved your questions. And
you've been listening to the Political Theory Review. Find us on the web and on iTunes. Thanks to the Starting Points Journal for partnering with us. And thanks to you for listening.